Accession number 27302, Reel 9.
Mr. Dobbs, Reel 9. Where did you go to next, Mr.
Dobbs? We moved on to a place called Stadlon. It was a town built on a very steep hill. But to get to this town, we had to cross over a series of railway junctions. And they had been heavily bombed by the planes previously. It was a difficult task getting over the obstacles. Eventually we got into the town and we had to do house clearing. Half the platoon went down one side of the street and the other half on the other side. And in order to do house clearing, we used to go in pairs. On this particular house, myself and another lad went in while the rest of the section stood on guard outside. We went in and we raced up the stairs, and on the landing there were two doors leading into the rooms, and the doors were shut. So I nodded to my mate and we both rushed and kicked the door open, and we fired a burst as we went in. It's a wonder we didn't kill each other, because both the doors went into the same room. It was a bit of a shock, I can tell you. So anyway, after we found that there was no Germans there, we carried on with the same procedure down the full length of the street. And at the end of the street, we came under a heavy fire again. And another one of our Welsh pals got badly wounded. He was called Ivor Buttle. So he died of his wounds on the spot. And that was, and then we came out in the open country, and there was a few Germans in a hedge row there, and they had bazookas. They were ready to fire at our tanks, but we didn't have any tanks with us at that particular time. So we opened fire on them and we got rid of them. And that was Stadlon.
Did you carry some form of first aid items with you to immediately deal with wounded?
Well, we had a little wallet containing bandages and that sort of thing, you know. But, it was just for your own personal use, more or less.
These would be dressings?
Dressings with the antiseptic on, like a pad.
How close would a stretcher bearer or a medical orderly be with you as you went into action? Were they very close behind?
We never saw them. They were well behind. They didn't come into action with us.
You see scenes of shouting out, you know, medic and this kind of thing. You didn't have them that close.
No. We just send word back, whatever possible, along the line. Pass the word right back to wherever they were, platoon HQ or something. Maybe a runner would go back from the end of the section, get back up to the HQ. And
how many men had you lost by now out of your particular group?
Well, we hadn't lost many at Stadlon, except for when we got to the end of the street. We lost Lance Corporal Ivor Buttle. I think he was the only one in that particular incident.
Where did you go next?
And then we went to Ibn Buren. So our platoon was given the task of reaching and holding a certain bridge. But in order to get to the area, we had to go down a narrow lane. It was running through a woods. And to get to the object, we had to cross a field and get past a farmhouse. But when we went down this lane in the woods and came out in the open, we found two British soldiers lying dead in the middle of the road. we didn't know who they were because they didn't belong to us, and we couldn't stop to identify them. We had to keep bashing on to our objective. So I think they must have been on patrol the night before to get caught up and to be shot in that way. Anyway, we got down towards this farmhouse and we came under heavy fire, and we dived into a ditch, and that was half filled with water. And there we discovered that our platoon sergeant, well, he was acting platoon commander, Sergeant Redpath, he was wounded. And the blood was spurting out of the centre of his back. And after a while, the firing cooled off a bit. And during the lull in the fighting, I saw a pole coming out of the doorway and a white flag attached to it. And this German soldier came out, and he was followed by a bunch of German soldiers. And in the end, about 40 turned up. So they were all bunched up together, and we frisked them to see that they had no weapons with them. And they were kept there with their hands up in the air. So I took a young lad with me, and we lifted a 5-barred gate off its hinges and brought it back to where all these prisoners were kept. We laid the gate on the floor, and I said to one lad who could speak a little bit of German, I said, get a couple of them to take their overcoats off and place them on that gate. So he did that, and we put the sergeant on the gate on its makeshift stretcher. And I always remember I took out a packet of cigarettes and I lit one and put it in his mouth, and he thanked me for it, and I lit one for myself. And the German prisoner was shouting, cigaretten, cigaretten. He was expecting me to hand them around them. However, I made the prisoners lift this gate with the sergeant on, and we took them back into our lines. Now, there were so many of these prisoners there that there was about 8 at a time carrying the stretcher, and they were taking shifts in changing over with each other. So you can just imagine how many there were. There must have been about 40 anyway. So we got them back into our lines and handed them over, and we handed the... Well, we didn't hand him over. I shouted for the stretcher bearers to come and tend to the sergeant. And I never knew what happened to him after that. And then when I returned back to my section, which they had been under fire heavily while I was away. And the Lance Sergeant Hopkinson, he was killed. And there was another Welsh lad there called George Baker. He was a private soldier, but because we were so short of NCOs at the time, we nominated him as section leader. Unfortunately, during this session of firing again, he got wounded. And then I realized that I was the senior NCO left. I didn't want to lose any more of the platoon, so I said to the wireless operator, he was all right, like, I said, get through on the blower to HQ and tell them that we need support straight away. And he was fiddling around with the controls on the set. I can't get the frequency, he said. I played hell with him. I said, if I wanted bloody dance music, you'd get that quick enough. So eventually he said, I've got through, I've passed the message on. And then, after what seemed a long time, but in actual fact it was maybe a quarter of an hour, 20 minutes, we heard the sounds of tanks approaching. At first we thought it might be Jerry tanks, but they turned out to be ours. And the town commander came up close and he shouted, "We've had orders to come and pick you up and take you back." So both the tanks pulled in near the side of one of the buildings. And we lifted the wounded men up onto the tank, onto the first tank. And the rest of the lads got on. Well, that left three of us for the remaining tank. The first tank, having loaded up with all he could carry, he moved off and headed back for our lines. And there were just three of us for the second tank. So we climbed aboard, and we sat with our backs to the turret, and Private Cox was on one side of me, and Private Dixon was on the other side. The tank moved away, and after a while I heard what sounded like a crack of a whip. I knew what that was, because I heard it so often. And when I looked up, after the crack of a whip, I looked up and I heard gasps. And both Dixon and Cox had been shot through the head. And there was nothing I could do at that particular time. So the tank carried on until we got back into our lines. And then, as soon as he stopped, I jumped off the tank and I shouted for the stretcher bearers to deal with what I thought was the wounded man. But Dixon was already dead, and Cox was in convulsions. They lifted him on, put him on side of the road, but he didn't last very long.
So that was a remarkable escape.
It was. I was under the impression that in front of me there was a box of ammunition. And I'm convinced that if it hadn't been for that, obstructing the view of the sniper, he couldn't see me. That, otherwise I would have been shot with the other two.
Did you feel that at any time you had a guardian angel or something that was...
Yes, I'm sure there must have been, because it was not planned. It was just where we scrambled onto the tank and sat down. This ammunition box was more or less directly in front of me. It wasn't planned that I should go and sit behind that. But I'm sure that's what saved my life.
What is the initial reaction when incidents like that, where you see men shot so close to you and that you survive?
Yes, it was frightening. It's very frightening.
Do you feel, is the first feeling one of relief that you're looking at people, well, you know, friends, but you're there?
You're concerned for yourself. I wonder where the next shot's coming from. But fortunately, we got back onto our lines. And the following day, we were pulled out of the line for arrest. Major Teller was our company commander in those days. So during the time we were out of the line, he came up to me and he said, "I'm making you up to a sergeant." So that was promotion on the battlefield, so to speak. And then while we were out, I think we had about 5 or 6 days break. While we were out, there was a war reporter came, and he was seeking stories, you know. So he wanted to know all about Ibn Buren, what part we had taken him in that. He was asking, first of all, he went to the office and asked him about it, and then he came to me and asked what I'd seen. And I never knew anymore, never thought anymore about it, until I came home on leave. And when I came home on leave, I was presented with a newspaper cutting. Beaufort Corporal took command. I was surprised to see that, really.
So the actions you've just described were Ibn Buren?
Ibn Buren, yes, yes.
Who were you against?
No, that we found out later that they were from the Nazi training school, which was close by. And they were fanatics, there's no doubt about it, because they fought with tenacity all the time. Yes. I'm surprised that when so many prisoners came and gave themselves up, that there were still snipers left behind to cause so much damage, you know.
Had you come across any German civilians during this course of time?
Not at that particular place. usually when we went into towns or villages, they would all be huddled in their cellars and that, you know. Yes, they were too frightened to come out.
But you didn't get a sense of, you know, that they still felt they could win the war or...
No.
...support for Hitler of the...
No. Later on we went to another place which... I'm trying to think now of the name of it. Oh, a place called Maschen. M-A-S-C-H-E-N. And there we had to check the houses for any Germans or snipers in there. And we entered one house, and there was, it was just occupied by this one middle-aged woman, and she could speak very good English. And while we were talking, there were some shells landed close by. And she said, "Is that shells from the British guns?" I said, "No, they're from the German guns." "Oh," she said, "I don't believe that." She said, "The Germans wouldn't fire upon their own people." I said, "Well, they're not firing upon you, they're firing upon us because they know that we're in this vicinity." So, however, she left the room where myself and two or three of the lads were, and she came back a few minutes later, and she had a little, she said, "I wanted to have this." And she had a little box, and inside it was a Derringer pistol. A beautiful little thing. And it had the swastika on each side of the handle. And she gave me a box of 6mm bullets to go with it. And then she left the room again. And just to get the feel of the gun, I held it and pointed it towards the window, you know, pressed the trigger. Bang! I didn't know the bloody thing had a bullet in the spout. It was quite a shock, but it made such a noise for a little gun.
Going through villages and townships, did you have, you know, your men or any men going in and looting and bringing stuff out?
Well, there was occasions when the temptation was great. If you saw anything there, something that you could carry very easily, like a watch or jewellery, something you put in your pocket. I suppose that's what the Germans would do with other people, as they did with the Jews.
Were there any army orders that looting should not take place?
Well, there was really, but we wasn't given that order on every action we took.
And the attitude to civilians when you came on them, was it aggressive or abusive towards them?
No, I don't think so, because we realised that they were pleased that more or less the war was over for them. They were so pleased that they didn't have to suffer the bombardment that they had to endure before that.
So what happened next then?
We're coming up to May the 1st. And on May the 1st, we got news of Hitler's death. And then, on the 2nd of May...
What was the immediate response to that?
Well, we all felt pleased, because we had an idea then that the war must be coming to a close. So it was great joy, really, to think that the Führer was out of action. And then on the 2nd of May, that was the day that Italy surrendered. So that was another great bit of news. On the same day, on the 2nd of May, I got news that my name had come up for leave. I hadn't had leave all the time I was over in Europe. So, in the meantime, there was two German officers come through our line. They were waving white flags, and they were allowed to go through to HQ. We didn't know at the time that they were on a peace-finding mission.
Can I ask you, did you actually see them coming, these two men?
I didn't see those two, no. But they passed through another one of our sections. And I'm trying to think now. So anyway, we were scheduled for to attack Hamburg, because we were at a place called Harburg at the time, which was only a couple of miles out of Hamburg. And on this particular day, Major Tell said, we're going to attack Hamburg. So I said, my leave's due to start tonight, sir. What about LOB? That's left out of battle. He said, those two German officers that came was on a peace-finding mission. And they've been sent back with their safety assured to tell the garrison commander in Hamburg that everybody had to lay down their arms and stay indoors. And the only people on the street was to be the policemen directing traffic. So he said, they've been given a certain time to respond. If they don't respond in that time, we are going to attack. He said, our tanks are going to start blasting the way through. He said, if that's the case, Sergeant Dobbs, you'll bloody well fight before you go on leave. So, fortunately, we had word that Hamburg was going to be declared an open city. So we all clambered aboard the tanks and we drove through into the city and drove through it. And we were amazed there was hardly any houses left standing. And those that were standing were the civilians who was in there at the windows looking at what was going on. I think they must have been amazed at the amount of tanks and vehicles that was coming through their place. So we go right through Hamburg without any bother.
Were the white flags out?
Flags
in the window?
There was no. I can't remember seeing any flags at Hamburg.
And there was no reaction to you, in effect?
No, they just watched in silence, the one we saw.
What about the policemen that were...
The policemen, they were saluting every tank as it went past him. Yes, I'm sure his arm must have been eating by the end of the day. But we get through Hamburg and then we pull into a rendezvous area. And we were there for about 4 or 5 hours. And then the major came along. Major Tell, he said, you lucky bugger, you can go home on leave now. So that evening, I remember the leave party were assembling at the trucks. And the major said to one lad, he said, when you get to London, phone my mother and tell her I'm okay, and I'll ring her as soon as I get the chance. No, I'll write to her as soon as I get the chance. And the lad said, but I don't know your mother's phone number, sir. He said, well, look in the directory. We are the only terrorists in Wimbledon. So that was the end of that episode. And then we boarded the trucks and it took us about 5 days travelling from Hamburg until I arrived home.
And your family be pleased to see you?
Yes, well, as I say, we left the leave party, left the battalion and started to drive off. And I got, it must have been uncomfortable for those in the back, sitting on the wooden seats in the back of the trucks. It took 5 days from the time we left Hamburg until we reached home. We were held up for 2 days in Calais. The ferries were stopped due to rough weather. And when we got on board ship, I was able to send a telegram from the ship to Peggy, my wife, telling her when I would arrive home. And she was waiting at the station when I got there. Now, this was on May the 8th. And this was the official celebration of VE Day. And everybody was having street parties and enjoying themselves and celebrating. Wonderful.
And your own feelings? What were your own feelings on
that? I was pleased that the war was over and that, you know. And,
was there any kind of regretful feeling towards pals you'd lost?
Well, yes.
They fled in.
When I eventually left the army, I was sorry that I didn't collect their home addresses and that to keep in touch with, you know.
Did you get a great welcome yourself when you got home?
Yes, yes. Oh, they had the flags out and God knows what. Outside the wife's family's house. But they were having a street party as well. And of course, it wasn't for me, it was for the war being finished. Everybody was celebrating that. And I remember when we was back coming through London on the underground, you could hardly pass for the... During the war, the people would be sleeping on the platforms and that. You could hardly get past, you know, to board a train or anything. Yes, it was a very strange experience.
Then you'd return to the unit?
When, on May the 19th, I left Alnwick to start my journey back to... We stopped at Folkestone overnight, where we all assembled, ready for the Channel crossing. And then from Calais, we travelled again up in Germany by truck. We went to Osnabrück. Now, Osnabrück, it was a camp, and there was so much rain there, that it was like a paddy field. And I remember to get around from the tents to the dining hall or the ablutions, you had to walk on duck boards. And we were there a couple of days before we got the truck to take us back to our unit, which they had moved from Hamburg to a place called Nordhausted. That was 80 miles north of Hamburg. And then we had many moves after that.
What were they doing there? What were you doing up north of Hamburg?
Well, they were on what they call the Army of Occupation then. And then we were moved around several places. We went from, on the 30th of May, we went to Brookstead. 18th of June, we went to Bad Segeberg. 1st of July to Wilster. 8th of July, Cudency. That's on the Kaiser Wilhelm Canal. We were there for a few days, and we managed to get a boat and sail up and down the river, the canal there.
Were you bringing in German army people? You know, were they coming into you?
No, not then.
What about SS people? Were you searching for them?
No, I wasn't. I had nothing to do with that, really. But we were on the canal, and we had to watch for the people. They had to have a pass before they could cross the canal. And we had to check their passes before we would allow them to cross over the bridge at the canal.
Displaced persons? Did you have experience of displaced persons?
I didn't, but some of the battalion did. And also, I think it was a Belsen, one of the prison camps, we passed close by. But I didn't go into it myself, right? And then on the 19th of July, I was picked to go to Army headquarters at Bad Oeynhausen to bring back the regimental colours from Army headquarters. There was a sergeant major and two sergeants with me to escort the colours back to our place. And later on, when we were stationed in Berlin, these colours were flown at the head of the victory parade.
And were you on that parade?
No, I missed. I was on my first leave when that happened. I was unfortunate there. On the 28th of July, we were told to get ready to move out. This time we were going to Berlin. We left Wilster and passed through Itzenhof, then Hamburg, Ulzen, if I can pronounce that correctly, and halted at Brunswick, and we stayed there overnight. We slept in the former SS barracks. At night time we had a walk around town, and we went into a museum. just to put the time in. And there we found there was the head of a Mongolian in a jar there. It was a bloody awful looking sight.